That boy. His head turned away from the camera, looking at Janie as if she'd just said something smart and funny. What did she say? Every time she always wondered that. What did you just say, Janie? Rachel pressed her fingertip to his grinning, freckled face and watched her mildly arthritic, age-spotted hand curl into a fist. The 6th of April, 1984. The first thing Janie Crowley did when she got out of bed that chilly April morning was jam the back of a chair beneath her door handle so neither of her parents could walk in on her. Then she got down on her knees next to her bed and heaved up the corner of her mattress to retrieve a pale blue box. She sat on the edge of her bed and removed a tiny yellow pill from its packet, holding it up on her fingertip, considering it and all that it symbolized, before placing it on the center of her tongue as reverently as a communion wafer. Then she re-hid the box under her mattress and jumped back into her warm bed, pulled the covers up and turned on her clock radio to the tinny sound of Madonna singing "Like a Virgin." The tiny pill tasted chemical, sweet, and deliciously sinful. "Think of your virginity as a gift. Don't just hand it over to any old fellow," her mother had said to her in one of those conversations where she was trying to pretend to be cool, as if any form of premarital sex would be okay, as if her father wouldn't fall to his knees and pray a thousand novenas at the thought of someone touching his pristine little girl. Janie had no intention of handing it over to just anyone. There'd been an application process, and today she would be informing the successful candidate. The news came on, and most of it was boring, sliding right off her consciousness, nothing to do with her. The only part that was interesting was that Canada's first test tube baby had been born. Australia already had a test tube baby. So we win, Canada! Ha ha! She had older Canadian cousins who made her feel inferior with their sophisticated niceness and their not-quite-American accents. She sat up in bed, grabbed her school diary, and drew a long, thin baby squashed into a test tube, its little hands pressed up against the glass, its mouth gaping. "Let me out! Let me out!" It would make the girls at school laugh. She snapped the diary shut. The idea of a test tube baby was somehow repellent. It reminded her of the day her science teacher started talking about a woman's eggs. Disgusting! And the worst part? Their science teacher was a man. A man talking about a woman's eggs. That was just so inappropriate. Janie and her friends were furious. Also, he probably wanted to look down all their shirts. They'd never actually caught him in the act, but they sensed his repulsive desire. It was a shame that Janie's life was going to end in just over 8 hours, because she wasn't her nicest self. She had been an adorable baby, a winsome little girl, a shy, sweet young teen, but around the time of her 17th birthday last May, she'd changed. She was dimly aware of her mild awfulness. It wasn't her fault. She was terrified of everything. University, driving a car, ringing up to make a hairdresser's appointment. And her hormones were making her crazy, and so many boys were starting to act kind of angrily interested in her, as if maybe she was pretty, which was nice, but confusing, because when she looked in the mirror, all she could see was her ordinary, loathsome face and her weird, long, skinny body. She looked like a praying mantis. One of the girls at school had told her that, and it was true. Her limbs were too long, her arms especially. She was all out of proportion. Also, her mother had something odd going on at the moment, which meant she wasn't concentrating on Janie, and up until recently, she'd always concentrated on her with such irritating fierceness. Her mother was 40. What could possibly be going on in her life that was so interesting? It was unsettling to have that bright spotlight of attention vanish without warning. Hurtful, really, although she wouldn't have admitted that, or even been aware that she was hurt. If Janie had lived, her mother would have returned to her normal, fiercely concentrating self, and Janie would have become lovely again around the time of her 19th birthday, and they would have been as close as a mother and daughter can be. And Janie would have buried her mother, instead of the other way around. If Janie had lived, she would have dabbled in soft drugs and rough boys, water aerobics and gardening, Botox and tantric sex. During the course of her lifetime, she would have had 3 minor car crashes, 34 bad colds, and 2 major surgeries. She would have been a moderately successful graphic designer, a nervy scuba diver, a whiny camper, an enthusiastic bushwalker, and an early adopter of the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. She would have divorced her first husband and had IVF twins with her second, and the words test tube babies would have flitted like an old joke across her mind while she posted their photos on Facebook for her Canadian cousins to like. She would have changed her name to Jane when she was 20 and back to Janie when she was 30. If Janie Crowley had lived, she would have travelled and dieted, danced and cooked, laughed and cried, watched a lot of television, and tried her very best. But none of that was going to happen, because it was the morning of the last day of her life, and although she would have enjoyed watching the mascara-streaked faces of her friends as they made a spectacle of themselves, clutching each other and sobbing at her gravesite in an orgy of grief, she really would have preferred to have found out all the things that were waiting to happen to her. Tuesday. Chapter 6. Cecilia spent most of Sister Ursula's funeral thinking about sex. Not kinky sex. Nice, married, approved by the Pope sex. But still, Sister Ursula probably wouldn't have appreciated it.
Sister Ursula was devoted to the children of St. Angela's.
Father Joe gripped both sides of the lectern, gazing solemnly at the tiny group of mourners, although, truthfully now, was anyone in this entire church really mourning Sister Ursula? And for a moment, his eyes seemed to meet Cecilia's, as if for approval. Cecilia bobbed her head and smiled slightly to show him that he was doing a good job. Father Joe was only 30, and not an unattractive man. What made a man in this day and age choose the priesthood? Choose celibacy? So, back to sex. Sorry, Sister Ursula. She first remembered noticing that there was a problem with their sex life last Christmas. She and John Paul didn't seem to be going to bed at the same time. Either he'd be up late, working or surfing the net, and she'd be asleep before he came to bed, or else he'd suddenly announce he was exhausted and go to bed at 9 o'clock. The week slipped on by, and every now and then she'd think, gosh, it's been a while, and then forget about it. Then there was that night back in February, when she'd gone out to dinner with some of the Year 4 mums, and she'd drunk more than usual because Penny Maroney was driving. Cecilia had felt amorous when she'd got into bed, but John Paul had brushed her hand away and mumbled, "Too tired. Leave me alone, you drunken woman." She'd laughed and fallen asleep, not at all offended. The next time he initiated sex, she was going to make a jokey remark like, "Oh, so now you want it." But she never got the opportunity. That's when she started to register the days ticking on by. What was going on? She thought it had probably been about 6 months now. And the more time that passed, the more confused she got. Yet whenever the words started to form in her mouth, "Hey, what's going on, honey?" something stopped her. Sex had never been an issue of contention between them, the way she knew it was between many couples. She didn't use it as a weapon or a bargaining tool. It was something unspoken and natural and beautiful. She didn't want to ruin that. Maybe she just didn't want to hear his answer. Or worse, his lack of an answer. Last year, John Paul had taken up rowing. He'd loved it, and come home each Sunday raving about how much he enjoyed it. But then, he'd unexpectedly, inexplicably quit the team. "I don't want to talk about it," he'd said, when she'd kept asking, desperate for a reason. "Give it a rest." John Paul could be so odd at times. She hurried over the thought. Besides, she was pretty sure all men were odd at times. Also, 6 months wasn't actually that long, was it? Not for a married, middle-aged couple. Penny Moroney said they did it once a year, if they were lucky. Recently, though, Cecilia had felt like a teenage boy, thinking constantly about sex. Mildly pornographic images flickered across her mind as she stood at the checkout. She chatted in the playground with the other parents about the upcoming excursion to Canberra, while simultaneously remembering a hotel in Canberra where John Paul had tied her wrists together with the blue plastic band the physio had given her for her ankle exercises. They'd left the blue band in the hotel room. Cecilia's ankle still clicked when she turned it a certain way. How did Father Joe cope? She was a 42-year-old woman, an exhausted mother of 3 daughters, with menopause right there on the horizon, and she was desperate for sex. So surely Father Joe McKenzie, a fit young man who got plenty of sleep, found it difficult. Did he masturbate? Were Catholic priests allowed, or was that considered not within the spirit of the whole celibacy thing? Wait, wasn't masturbation a sin for everyone? This was something her non-Catholic friends would expect her to know. They seemed to think she was a walking Bible. Truth be told, if she ever had time to think about it, she wasn't sure she was even that enthusiastic a fan of God anymore. He seemed to have dropped the ball a long time ago. Appalling things happened to children all across the world, every single day. It was inexcusable. Little Spider-Man. She closed her eyes, blinked the image away. Cecilia didn't care what the fine print said about free will and God's mysterious ways and blah-de-blah. If God had a supervisor, she would have sent off one of her famous letters of complaint a long time ago. "You have lost me as a customer." She looked at Father Joe's humble, smooth-skinned face. Once, he'd told her that he found it really interesting when people questioned their faith. But she didn't find her doubts all that relevant. She believed in St. Angela's with all her heart, the school, the parish, the community it represented. She believed that love one another was a lovely moral code by which to live her life. The sacraments were beautiful, timeless ceremonies. The Catholic Church was the team for which she'd always barracked. As for God and whether he or she was doing that great a job, well, that was another matter altogether. And yet everyone thought she was the ultimate Catholic. She thought of Bridget saying at dinner the other night, "How did you get to be so Catholic?" when Cecilia mentioned something perfectly ordinary about Polly's first confession next year, or reconciliation, as they called it these days. As if her sister hadn't been quite the little liturgical dance queen when they were at school. Cecilia would have given her sister a kidney without hesitation, but sometimes she really wanted to straddle her and hold a pillow over her face. It had been an effective way of keeping her in line when they were kids. It was unfortunate the way adults had to repress their true feelings. Of course, Bridget would give Cecilia a kidney too. She'd just grown a lot more during the recovery process, and mention it at every opportunity, and make sure Cecilia covered all her expenses. Father Joe had wrapped things up. The scattered group of people in the church got to their feet for the final hymn with a gentle murmur of suppressed sighs, subdued coughs, and the cracking of middle-aged knees. Cecilia caught Melissa McNulty's eye across the aisle. Melissa raised her eyebrows to indicate, "Aren't we good people for coming to Sister Ursula's funeral when she was so awful and we're so busy?" Cecilia gave her a rueful half-shrug that said, "But isn't that always the way?" She had a Tupperware order in the car to give to Melissa after the funeral, and she must remember to confirm with her that she would be taking care of Polly at ballet this afternoon, because she had Esther's speech therapy and Isabel's haircut. Speaking of which, Melissa really needed to get her hair colour redone. Her black roots looked dreadful. It was uncharitable of Cecilia to notice, but she couldn't help but remember being on Canteen with Melissa last month and hearing her complain about how her husband wanted sex every second day, like clockwork. As Cecilia sang along to "How Great Thou Art," she thought about Bridget's teasing remark at dinner and knew why it had bothered her. It was because of the sex. Because if she wasn't having sex, she wasn't anything else except an uncool, middle-aged, frumpy mum. And by the way, she was not frumpy. Just yesterday, a truck driver had given her a long, slow wolf whistle when she was running against the lights to buy coriander. The whistle had definitely been for her. She checked to make sure there hadn't been any other younger, more attractive women in sight. The previous week, she'd had the disconcerting experience of hearing someone whistle when she was walking with the girls through the shopping centre, and she'd turned to see Isabel looking resolutely ahead, her cheeks flushed pink. Isabel had suddenly shot up. She was already as tall as Cecilia, and she was starting to curve, in at the waist, out at the hips and bust. Lately, she'd been wearing her hair up in a high ponytail, with a heavy, straight fringe hanging too low over her eyes. She was growing up, and it wasn't only her mother who was noticing. "It's starting," Cecilia had thought sadly. She wished she could give Isabel a shield, like the ones riot police held, to protect her from male attention. That feeling of being scored each time you walked down a street. The demeaning comments yelled out of cars, that casual sweep of the eyes. She'd wanted to sit down and talk to Isabel about it, but then she hadn't known what to say. She'd never quite got her head around it herself. It's no big deal. It is a big deal. They have no right to make you feel that way. Or just ignore it. One day you'll turn 40 and you'll slowly realize you don't feel the eyes anymore, and the freedom is a relief, but you'll also sort of miss it. And when a truck driver whistles at you while you're crossing the road, you'll think, "Really? For me?" It had seemed like a really genuine, friendly whistle, too. It was a little humiliating just how much time she'd devoted to analyzing that whistle. Well, anyway, she was certainly not worried that John Paul was having an affair. Definitely not. It wasn't a possibility. Not even a remote possibility. He wouldn't have time for an affair. When would he fit it in? He did travel a bit. He could fit in an affair then. Sister Ursula's coffin was being carried from the church by four broad-shouldered, tousle-haired young men in suits and ties, with careful blank faces, who were supposedly her nephews. Fancy Sister Ursula sharing the same DNA as such attractive young boys. They'd probably spent the whole funeral thinking about sex, too. Young boys like that with their roaring young libidos. The tallest one really was particularly good-looking, with those dark, flashing eyes. Dear God, now she was imagining having sex with one of Sister Ursula's pallbearers. A child, by the look of him. He was probably still in high school. Her thoughts were not only immoral and inappropriate, but also illegal. Was it illegal to think, to covet your third-grade teacher's pallbearer? When John Paul got home from Chicago on Good Friday, they would have sex every single night. They would rediscover their sex lives. It would be great. They'd always been so good together. She'd always assumed that they were having better quality sex than everyone else. It had been such a cheering thought at school functions. John Paul couldn't get better sex anywhere else. Cecilia had read a lot of books. She'd kept her skills up to date, as if it were a professional obligation. He had no need for an affair, not to mention that he was one of the most ethical, rule-following people she knew. He wouldn't cross a double yellow line for $1 million. Infidelity was not an option for him. He just would not do it. That letter had nothing to do with an affair. She wasn't even thinking about the letter. That's how unconcerned she was about it. That fleeting moment last night when she thought he'd been lying on the phone was completely imaginary. The awkwardness over the letter was just because of the innate awkwardness of all long-distance phone calls. They were unnatural. You were on opposite sides of the world, at opposite ends of the day, so you couldn't quite harmonize your voices. One person too upbeat, the other too mellow. Opening the letter would not result in some shocking revelation. It was not, for example, about another secret family he was supporting. John Paul did not have the requisite organizational abilities to handle bigamy. He would have slipped up long ago, turned up at the wrong house, called one of his wives by the wrong name. He'd be constantly leaving his possessions at the other place. Unless, of course, his hopelessness was all part of his duplicitous cover. Perhaps he was gay. That's why he'd gone off sex. He'd been faking his heterosexuality all these years. Well, he'd certainly done a good job of it. She thought back to the early years when they used to have sex 3 or 4 times in one day. That really would have been above and beyond the call of duty if he was only faking his interest. He quite enjoyed musicals. He loved cats. And he was better at doing the girl's hair than her. Whenever Polly had a ballet concert, she insisted that John Paul be the one to put her hair in a bun. He could talk arabesques and pirouettes with Polly, as well as he could talk soccer with Isabel, and the Titanic with Esther. Also, he adored his mother. Weren't gay men particularly close to their mothers? Or was that a myth? He owned an apricot polo shirt and ironed it himself. Yes, he was probably gay. The hymn finished. Sister Ursula's coffin left the church and there was a sense of a job well done as people picked up their bags and jackets and got ready to go on with their day. Cecilia put down her hymn book. For heaven's sake, her husband was not gay. An image came to her of John Paul marching up and down the sidelines at Isabel's soccer match last weekend, calling out encouragement. Along with a day's worth of silver stubble, he had 2 purple ballerina stickers stuck on each cheek. Polly had put them there to amuse herself. She felt a surge of love as she remembered. There was nothing effeminate about John Paul. He was just comfortable in his own skin. He didn't need to prove himself. The letter had nothing to do with the sex lull. It had nothing to do with anything. It was safely locked away in the filing cabinet in the red manila folder with the copies of their wills. She'd promised not to open it. So she couldn't. And she wouldn't. Chapter 7. "Do you know who died?" asked Tess. "What's that?" Her mother had her eyes closed, her face lifted to the sun. They were in the St. Angela's Primary School playground. Tess's mother was in a wheelchair they'd hired from the local chemist, with her ankle propped up on the footrest. She had thought that her mother would hate being in a wheelchair, but she seemed to quite enjoy it, sitting with perfect straight-back posture, as if she were at a dinner party. They'd stopped for a moment in the morning sunshine while Liam explored the schoolyard. There were a few minutes to spare before they saw the school secretary to arrange Liam's enrolment. Tessa's mother had arranged everything this morning. There would be no problem enrolling Liam in St. Angela's, Lucy had told Tess proudly. In fact, they could do it that very day if they liked. "There's no rush," Tess had said. "We don't need to do anything until after Easter." She hadn't asked her mother to ring the school. Wasn't she entitled to do nothing but feel flabbergasted for at least 24 hours? Her mother was making everything seem far too real and irrevocable, as if this nightmarish practical joke was actually happening. "I can cancel the appointment if you like," Lucy had said with a martyred air. "You made an appointment?" asked Tess. "Without asking me?" "Well, I thought we might as well bite the bullet." "Fine," sighed Tess. "Let's just do it." Naturally, Lucy had insisted on coming along too. She would probably answer questions on Tess's behalf, like she used to do when Tess was little and overcome with shyness when a stranger approached. Her mother had never really lost the habit of speaking on her behalf. It was a little embarrassing, but also quite nice and relaxing, like five-star service at a hotel. Why not sit back and let someone else do all the hard work for you? "Do you know who died?" said Tess again.
"Died?"
"The funeral," said Tess. The school playground adjoined the grounds of St. Angela's Church, and Tess could see a coffin being carried out to a hearse by four young pallbearers. Someone's life was over. Someone would never feel the sunshine on their face again. Tess tried to let that thought put her own pain into perspective, but it didn't help. She wondered if Will and Felicity were having sex right at this minute, in her bed. It was mid-morning. They didn't have anywhere else to go. The thought of it felt like incest to her. Dirty and wrong. She shuddered. There was a bitter taste at the back of her throat, as if she'd had a night out drinking cheap wine. Her eyes felt gritty. The weather wasn't helping. It was far too lovely, mocking her pain. Sydney was bathed in a haze of gold. The Japanese maples at the front of the school were aflame with colour. The camellia blossoms were a rich, lush crimson. There were pots of bright red, yellow, apricot and cream begonias outside the classrooms. The long sandstone lines of St. Angela's Church were sharply defined against the cobalt blue of the sky. "The world is so beautiful," said Sydney to Tess. "What's your problem?" She tried to smooth away the jagged edge of her voice. "You don't know whose funeral it is?" She didn't really care whose funeral it was. She just wanted to hear words. Words about anything, to make those images of Will's hands on Felicity's newly slender white body go away. Porcelain skin. Tess's skin was darker, a legacy from her father's side of the family. There was a Lebanese great-grandmother who had died before Tess was born. Will had called her mobile that morning. She should have ignored it, but when she'd seen his name, she'd felt an involuntary spark of hope and snatched up the phone. He was calling to tell her that this was all a mistake. Of course he was. But as soon as he spoke in that awful, new, heavy, solemn voice, without a hint of laughter, the hope vanished. "Are you okay?" he asked. "Is Liam all right?" He was speaking as if there had been a recent tragedy in their lives that had nothing to do with him. She was desperate to tell the real Will what this new Will, this humorless intruder, had done, how he'd crushed her heart. The real Will would want to fix things for her. The real Will would be straight on the phone, making a complaint about the way his wife had been treated, demanding recompense. The real Will would make her a cup of tea, run her a bath, and finally make her see the funny side of what had just happened to her. Except, this time, there was no funny side. Her mother opened her eyes and turned her head to squint up at Tess. "I think it must be for that dreadful little nun." Tess raised her eyebrows to indicate mild shock, and her mother grinned, pleased with herself. She was so determined to make Tess happy, she was like a club entertainer, frantically trying out edgy new material to keep the crowd in their seats. This morning, when she was struggling with the lid on the Vegemite jar, she'd actually used the word motherfucker, carefully sounding out the syllables so that the word didn't sound any more profane than leprechaun. Her mother had pulled out the most shocking swear word in her vocabulary because she was ablaze with anger on her behalf. Lucy saying motherfucker was like a meek and mild law-abiding citizen suddenly transformed into a gun-wielding vigilante. That's why she'd got on the phone to the school so fast. Tess understood. She wanted to take action, to do something, anything, on Tess's behalf. Which particular dreadful little nun? "Where's Liam?" Her mother twisted around awkwardly in her wheelchair. "Right there," said Tess. Liam was wandering about, checking out the playground equipment with the jaded eye of a 6-year-old expert. He hunkered down on his knees at the bottom of a big yellow funnel-shaped slide and poked his head up inside, as if he was doing a safety audit. "I lost sight of him for a moment." "You don't have to keep him in sight all the time," said Tess mildly. "That's sort of my job." "Of course it is." At breakfast this morning, they'd both wanted to take care of each other. Tess had had the advantage because she had 2 working ankles and had therefore been able to get the kettle boiled and the tea made in the time it had taken her mother to reach for her crutches. Tess watched Liam wander over to the corner of the playground under the fig tree, where she and Felicity used to sit and eat their lunch with Eloise Bungonia. Eloise had introduced them to cannelloni. A mistake for someone with Felicity's metabolism. Mrs. Bungonia used to send enough for the 3 of them. It was before childhood obesity was an issue. Tess could still taste it. Divine. She watched Liam become still, staring off into space as if he could see his mother eating cannelloni for the first time. It was disconcerting being here at her old school, as if time was a blanket that had been folded up so that different times were overlapping, pressed against each other. She would have to remind Felicity about Mrs. Bungonia's cannelloni. No. No, she wouldn't. Liam suddenly pivoted and karate kicked the rubbish bin so that it clanged. "Liam," remonstrated Tess, but not really loud enough for him to hear. "Liam, shh," called her mother, louder, putting a finger to her lips and pointing towards the church. A small group of mourners had come out and were standing about talking to each other in that restrained, relieved way of funeral attendees. Liam didn't kick the bin again. He was an obedient child. Instead, he picked up a stick and held it in 2 hands like a machine gun, aiming it silently around the schoolyard, while the sound of sweet little voices singing "Incy Wincy Spider" floated out of one of the kindergarten classrooms. Oh, God, thought Tess, where had he learned to do that? She had to be more vigilant about those computer games, although she couldn't help admiring the authentic way he narrowed his eyes like a soldier. She would tell Will about it later. He'd laugh. No, she wouldn't tell Will about it later. Her brain couldn't seem to catch up with the news. It was like the way she'd kept rolling towards Will last night in her sleep, only to find empty space where he should have been, and then waking up with a jolt. She and Will slept well together. No twitching or snoring or battling for blankets. "I can't sleep properly without you now," Will had complained after they'd only been dating a few months. You're like a favorite pillow. I have to pack you wherever I go.
Which particular dreadful nun died?
Tess asked her mother again, her eyes on the mourners. Now was not the time to be pulling out old memories like that.
They weren't all dreadful, reflected her mother. Most of them were lovely. What about Sister Margaret Ann, who came to your 10th birthday party? She was beautiful. I think your father quite fancied her.
Seriously?
Well, probably not.
Her mother shrugged as if not being attracted to beautiful nuns was yet another example of her ex-husband's failings.
Anyway, this must be the funeral for Sister Ursula. I read in the parish newsletter last week that she'd died. I don't think she ever taught you, did she? Apparently she was a great one for smacking with the handle of the feather duster.
Nobody uses feather dusters much these days, do they?
Is the world a dustier place for it, I wonder?
I think I remember Sister Ursula, said Tess, red face and caterpillar eyebrows. We used to hide from her when she was on playground duty.
I'm not sure if there are any nuns teaching at the school anymore, said her mother. They're a dying breed.
Literally, said Tess.
Her mother chortled. Oh, dear, I didn't mean... She stopped, distracted by something at the church entrance. Okay, darling, steel yourself. We've just been spotted by one of the parish ladies.
What?
Tess was immediately filled with a sense of dread, as if her mother had said they'd just been spotted by a passing sniper. A petite blonde woman had detached herself from the mourners and was briskly walking towards the schoolyard. Cecilia Fitzpatrick, said her mother, the eldest Bell girl. Married John Paul, the eldest Fitzpatrick boy. The best-looking one, if you want my opinion, although they're all much of a muchness. Cecilia had a younger sister, I think, who might have been in your year. Let's see now. Bridget Bell? Tess was about to say she'd never heard of them, but a memory of the Bell girls was gradually emerging in her mind like a reflection on water. She couldn't visualize their faces, just their long, blonde, stringy plaits flying behind them as they ran through the school, doing whatever those kids did who were at the center of things.
Cecilia sells Tupperware, said Tess's mother. Makes an absolute fortune from it.
But she doesn't know us, does she? Tess looked hopefully over her shoulder to see if there might be someone else waving back at Cecilia. There was no one. Was she on her way over to Spruik Tupperware?
Cecilia knows everyone, said her mother.
Can't we make a run for it?
Too late now.
Her mother spoke through the side of her mouth as she smiled her toothy social smile.
Lucy, said Cecilia as she arrived in front of them, faster than Tess had thought possible. It was like she'd teleported herself. She bent to kiss Tess's mother. What have you done to yourself?
Don't you call my mother Lucy? Thought Tess, taking an instant childish dislike. Mrs. O'Leary, thank you. Now that she was right in front of them, Tess remembered Cecilia's face perfectly well. She had a small, neat head. The plaits had been replaced with one of those crisp, artful bobs. An eager, open face. A noticeable overbite, and two ridiculously huge dimples. She was like a pretty little ferret. And yet she'd landed a Fitzpatrick boy.
I saw you when I came out of the church, Sister Ursula's funeral. Did you hear that she'd passed? Anyway, I caught sight of you and I thought, that's Lucy O'Leary in a wheelchair. What's going on? So, being the nosy Parker that I am, I came over to say hello. Looks like a good quality wheelchair. Did you hire it from the chemist? But what happened, Lucy? Your ankle, is it?
Oh, Lord. Tess could feel her entire personality being drained from her body. Those talkative, energetic people always left her feeling that way.
It's nothing too serious, thanks, Cecilia, said Tess's mother. Just a broken ankle. Oh, no. But that is serious, you poor thing. How are you coping? How are you getting about? I'll bring over a lasagna for you. No, I will. I insist. You're not vegetarian, are you? But that's why you're here, I guess, is it? Without warning, Cecilia turned to look at Tess, who took an involuntary step backwards. What did she mean? Something to do with vegetarianism. To look after your mum. I'm Cecilia, by the way, if you don't remember me. Cecilia, this is my daughter, began Tess's mother, only to be cut off by Cecilia. Of course! Tess, isn't it? Cecilia turned and, to Tess's surprise, held out her hand to shake in a businesslike way. Tess had been thinking of Cecilia as someone from her mother's era, an old-fashioned Catholic lady who used Catholic words like past, and would therefore stand back smiling sweetly while the men did the manly business of shaking hands. Her hand was small and dry, her grip strong. "And this must be your son," Cecilia smiled brightly in Liam's direction. "Liam?" Jesus, she even knew Liam's name. How was that possible? Tess didn't even know if Cecilia had children. She'd forgotten her very existence until 30 seconds ago. Liam looked over, aimed his stick straight at Cecilia, and pulled the imaginary trigger. "Liam!" said Tess, at the same time as Cecilia groaned, clutched her chest, and buckled at the knees. She did it so well, for an awful moment Tess worried that she really was collapsing. Liam held the stick up to his mouth, blew on it, and grinned, delighted. "How long do you think you'll be in Sydney for?" Cecilia locked eyes with Tess. She was one of those people who held eye contact for too long. The polar opposite of Tess. "Just until you've got Lucy back on her feet? You run a business in Melbourne, don't you? I guess you can't be away for too long. And Liam must be in school." Tess found herself unable to speak. "Tess is actually enrolling Liam in St. Angela's for a short time," spoke up Lucy.
"Oh, that's wonderful," said Cecilia. Her eyes were still fixed on Tess.
Good Lord, did the woman ever blink?
"So, let's see now. How old is Liam?"
6, said Tess. She dropped her eyes, unable to bear it any longer.
"Well then, he'll be in Polly's class. We had a little girl leave earlier in the year, so you'll be in with us. 1J, Mrs. Jeffers. Mary Jeffers. She's wonderful, by the way. Very social, too, which is nice."
"Great," said Tess weakly. "Fabulous."
"Liam, now you've shot me, come and say hello. I hear you're coming to St. Angela's."
Cecilia beckoned to Liam, and he wandered over, dragging his stick behind him. Cecilia bent at the knees, so she was at Liam's eye level.
"I have a little girl who will be in your class. Her name is Polly. She's having her 7th birthday party the week after Easter. Would you like to come?"
Liam's face instantly got the blank look that always made Tess worry people would think he had some kind of disability.
"It's going to be a pirate party."
Cecilia straightened and turned to Tess.
"I hope you can come. It will be a good way for you to meet all the mums. We'll have a private little oasis for the grown-ups. Guzzle champagne while the little pirates rampage about."
Tess felt her own face fold up. Liam had probably inherited his catatonic look from her. She could not meet another brand new group of mothers. She'd found socializing with the school mums difficult enough when her life was in perfect order. The chat, 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 the swirls of laughter, the warmth, the friendliness. Most mums were so very nice, and the gentle hint of bitchiness that ran beneath it all. She'd done it in Melbourne, She'd made a few friends on the outskirts of the inner social circle, but she couldn't do it again. Not now. She didn't have the strength. It was like someone had cheerfully suggested she run a marathon when she'd just dragged herself out of bed after suffering from the flu. "Great," she said. She would make up an excuse later.
"I'll make Liam a pirate costume," said Tess's mother. "An eye patch, a red and white striped top, oh, and a sword. You'd love a sword, wouldn't you, Liam?"
She looked around for Liam, but he'd run off and was using his gun like a drill against the back fence.
"Of course, we'd love to have you at the party too, Lucy," said Cecilia.
She was highly irritating, but her social skills were impeccable. For Tess, it was like watching someone play the violin beautifully. You couldn't conceive how they did it.
"Oh, well, thank you, Cecilia."
Tess's mother was delighted. She loved parties, especially the food.
"Let's see now. A red and white striped top for a pirate costume. Has he already got one, Tess?"
If Cecilia was a violinist, Tess's mother was a folksy, well-meaning guitarist, trying her best to play the same tune.
"I mustn't keep you. I guess you're off to see Rachel now in the office."
"We've got an appointment with the school secretary," said Tess. She had no idea of the woman's name.
"Yes, Rachel Crowley," said Cecilia. "So efficient. Runs the place like a Swiss watch. She actually shares the job with my mother-in-law, although between you and me in the gatepost, I think Rachel does all the work. Virginia just chats on her days."
"Not that I can talk."
"Well, actually, that's my point. I can talk."
She laughed merrily at herself.
"How is Rachel these days?" asked Tess's mother significantly. Cecilia's ferrety face got all somber.
"I don't know her that well, but I do know she has a beautiful little grandson, Jacob. He just turned 2.
"Ah," breathed Lucy, as if that solved everything. "That's good to hear. Jacob." "Well, it was so nice to meet you, Tess," said Cecilia, fixing her again with her unblinking stare. "I must skedaddle. I've got to get to my Zumba class. I go to the gym down the road. It's great. You should try it sometime. Just hilarious. And then I'm going straight to this party supply place in Strathfield. It's a bit of a drive, but it's worth it, because the prices are amazing. Seriously, you can get a helium balloon kit for under $50, and that gives you over 100 balloons, and I'm doing so many parties over the next few months. Polly's pirate party and the year one parents party, which of course you'll be invited to as well. And then I'm dropping off a few Tupperware orders. I do Tupperware, by the way, Tess, if you need anything. Anyway, all that before school pickup. You know how it is."
Tess blinked. It was like being buried in an avalanche of detail. The myriad of tiny logistical maneuvers that made up someone else's life. It wasn't that it was dull, although it was a little dull. It was mainly the sheer quantity of words that flowed so effortlessly from Cecilia's mouth. Oh, God, she stopped talking.
Tess registered with a start that it was her turn to speak.
"Busy,"
she said finally. "You sure are busy."
She forced her lips into something she hoped resembled a smile.
"See you at the pirate party,"
Cecilia called out to Liam, who turned from drilling his tree to look at her with that funny, inscrutable, masculine expression he sometimes got, an expression that painfully reminded Tess of Will. Cecilia lifted her hand like a claw.
"Aha, me hearties!"
Liam grinned, as if he couldn't help himself, and Tess knew she'd be taking him to the pirate party, whatever it cost her.
"Oh, my!" said Tess's mother when Cecilia was out of earshot. "Her mother is exactly the same. Very nice, but exhausting. I always feel like I need a cup of tea and a lie down after talking with her."
"What's the story with this Rachel Crowley?" asked Tess as they headed towards the school office, she and Liam pushing one handle each of the wheelchair. Her mother grimaced. "Do you remember the name Janie Crowley?" "Not the girl they found with the rosary beads."
"That's the one.
She was Rachel's daughter." Rachel could tell that Lucy O'Leary and her daughter were both thinking about Janie while they enrolled Tess's little boy in St. Angela's. They were both being just a little chattier than was obviously natural for them. Tess couldn't quite meet Rachel's eyes, while Lucy was doing that tender-eyed, tilted head thing that so many women of a certain age did when they talked to Rachel, as if they were visiting her in a nursing home. When Lucy asked if the photo on Rachel's desk was her grandson, both she and Tess went quite over the top with compliments. Not that it wasn't a beautiful photo of Jacob, of course, but you didn't need to be a rocket scientist to see that what they really meant was, "We know your daughter was murdered all those years ago, but does this little boy make up for it? Please, let him make up for it so we can stop feeling so strange and uncomfortable." "I look after him 2 days a week," Rachel told them, her eyes on the computer screen while she printed off some paperwork for Tess. "But not for much longer. I found out last night that his parents are taking him off to New York for 2 years." Her voice cracked without her permission, and she cleared her throat irritably. She waited for the reaction she'd been getting from everyone that morning. "How exciting for them! What an opportunity! Will you go for a visit?" "Well, that just takes the cake," exploded Lucy, and she banged her elbows on the arms of her wheelchair like a cranky toddler. Her daughter, who had been busy filling in a form, looked up and frowned. Tess was one of those plain-looking women with a short boyish haircut and strong austere features who sometimes stun you with a flash of raw beauty. Her little boy, who looked a lot like Tess except for his strange gold-coloured eyes, also turned to stare at his grandmother. Lucy rubbed her elbows. "Of course, I'm sure it's exciting for your son and daughter-in-law. It's just that after all you've been through, losing Janie, like, the way you did, and then your husband. I'm so sorry, I can't actually remember his name, but I know you lost him too. Well, this just doesn't seem fair." By the time she'd finished talking, her cheeks were crimson. Rachel could tell she was horrified at herself. People were always worrying that they'd inadvertently reminded her of her daughter's death, as if it was something that slipped her mind. "I'm so sorry, Rachel. I shouldn't have..." Poor Lucy looked distraught. Rachel waved a hand to swat away her apologies. "Don't be sorry. Thank you. It does take the cake, actually. I'll miss him terribly." "Well now, who have we here?" Rachel's boss, Trudy Appleby, the school principal, floated into the room, one of her trademark crocheted shawls slipping off her bony shoulders, strands of grey frizzy hair floating around her face, a smudge of red paint on her left cheekbone. She'd probably been on the floor painting with the kindergarten children. True to form, Trudy looked straight past Lucy and Tess O'Leary to the little boy, Liam. She had no interest in grown-ups, and this would one day be her downfall. Rachel had seen 3 school principals come and go since she'd been secretary, and in her experience it wasn't possible to run a school while ignoring the grown-ups. It was a political role. Also, Trudy didn't seem to be quite Catholic enough for the job. Not that she went around breaking the commandments, but she had an unpious, sparkly-eyed expression on her face during Mass. Before she died, Sister Ursula, whose funeral Rachel had just boycotted because she'd never forgiven her for hitting Janie with a feather duster, had probably written to the Vatican to complain about her.
"This is the boy I mentioned earlier," said Rachel, "Liam Curtis. He's enrolling in year one."
"Of course, of course. Welcome to St. Angela's, Liam. I was just thinking as I walked up the stairs that today I was meeting someone whose name begins with the letter L, which happens to be one of my favorite letters. Tell me, Liam, out of these three things, which do you like best?" She folded back her fingers with each item. "Dinosaurs, aliens, superheroes." Liam considered the question gravely.
"He quite likes dino," began Lucy O'Leary. Tess put her hand on her mother's arm.
"Aliens," said Liam finally.
"Aliens," Trudy nodded. "Well, I will be keeping that in mind, Liam Curtis. And this is your mum and your grandmother, I'm guessing?"
"Yes, indeed, began Lucy O'Leary. "Lovely to meet you both."
Trudy smiled vaguely in their general direction. She turned back to Liam.
"When are you starting with us, Liam?"
"Tomorrow?"
"No," Tess looked alarmed. "Not until after Easter."
"Oh, live a little, I say. Jump right in while the iron is hot," said Trudy.
"Do you like Easter eggs, Liam?"
"Yes," said Liam adamantly, "because we're planning a gigantic Easter egg hunt tomorrow."
"I'm super good at Easter egg hunts," said Liam.
"Are you? Excellent. Well then, I'd better make it a super challenging hunt."
Trudy glanced at Rachel.
"Everything under control here, Rachel, with all the..."
She gestured sorrowfully at the paperwork, of which she knew nothing.
"All under control," said Rachel.
She was doing her best to help keep Trudy in a job, because she didn't see why the children of St. Angela's shouldn't have a school principal from Fairyland.
"Lovely, lovely. I'll leave you to it," said Trudy. And she wandered off into her office, pulling the door shut behind her, presumably so she could scatter fairy dust over her keyboard, as she certainly didn't do much else on her computer.
"My goodness, she's a different kettle of fish from Sister Veronica Mary," said Lucy quietly. Rachel snorted in appreciation. She remembered Sister Veronica Mary, who had been principal from 1965 through to 1980, very well. There was a knock, and Rachel looked up to see the tall, imposing shadow of a man through the frosted glass panel of her office before his head appeared inquiringly around the door. Him. She flinched, as if at the sight of a furry black spider. Not a perfectly plain-looking man. Actually, Rachel had heard other women call him gorgeous, which she found preposterous.
"Excuse me, Mrs. Crowley."
He could never get far enough away from his schoolboy self to call her Rachel, like the rest of the staff. Their eyes met, and as usual, his slid away first to rest somewhere above her head.
"Lies in his eyes," thought Rachel,
as she did virtually every time she saw him, as if it were an incantation or prayer.
"Lies in his eyes."
"Sorry to interrupt," said Connor Whidbey. "I just wondered if I could pick up those tennis camp forms."
"There's something that Whidbey boy isn't telling us," Sergeant Rodney Bellark had said all those years ago when he still had a head full of startlingly curly black hair.
"That kid has got lies in his eyes."
Rodney Bellark was retired now, as bald as a bandicoot. He called every year on Janie's birthday, and he liked to tell Rachel about his latest ailments. Someone else who got old while Janie stayed 17. Rachel handed over the tennis camp forms, and Connor's eyes fell on Tess.
"Tess O'Leary!"
His face was transformed so that he looked for a moment like the boy in Janie's photo album. Tess looked up, her face wary. She didn't seem to recognize Connor at all.
Connor!
He tapped his broad chest. Connor Whidbey.
Oh, Connor. Of course, it's so nice to...
Tess half rose and then found herself trapped by her mother's wheelchair.
Don't get up. Don't get up,
said Connor. He went to kiss Tess on the cheek just as she was starting to sit down again, so that his lips met her earlobe.
What are you doing here?
Asked Tess. She didn't seem especially pleased to see Connor.
I work here, he said.
As an accountant?
No, no, I had a career change a few years back. I'm the PE teacher.
You are? She said.
Well, that's...
Her voice drifted and she finally said, nice.
Connor cleared his throat. Well, anyway, it's very good to see you.
He glanced at Liam, went to speak, and then changed his mind and held up the sheaf of tennis forms.
Thanks for this, Mrs. Crowley.
My pleasure, Connor, said Rachel coldly. Lucy turned to her daughter as soon as Connor left.
Who is that?
Just someone I used to know. Years ago.
I don't think I remember him. Was he a boyfriend?
Mum? Tess gestured at Rachel and the paperwork in front of her.
Sorry,
Lucy smiled guiltily, while Liam looked up at the ceiling, stretched out his legs and yawned. Rachel saw that the grandmother, mother and grandson all had identical full upper lips. It was like a trick. Those bee-stung lips made them more beautiful than they actually were. She was suddenly inexplicably furious with all three of them.
Well, if you could just sign the allergies and medication sections here, she said to Tess, jabbing at the form with her fingertip. No, not there. Here. Then we'll be done and dusted.
Tess had her keys in the ignition to drive them home from the school when her mobile rang. She lifted it from the console to check who was calling. When she saw the name on the screen, she held up the phone for her mother to see. Her mother squinted at the phone and sat back with a shrug.
Well, I had to tell him. I promised him I'd always keep him up to date with what was going on in your life.
You promised him that when I was 10, said Tess. She held the phone up, trying to decide whether to answer it or let it go to voicemail.
Is it Dad?
Asked Liam from the back seat.
It's my dad, said Tess.
She'd have to talk to him sometime. Might as well be now. She took a breath and pressed the answer button.
Hi, Dad.
There was a pause. There was always a pause.
Hello, love, said her father. How are you?
Asked Tess in the hearty tone of voice she reserved for her father. When had they last spoken? Must have been Christmas Day.
I'm great, said her father dolefully.
Another pause.
I'm actually in the car with, began Tess at the same time as her father said, your mother told me.
They both stopped. It was always excruciating. No matter how hard she tried, she could never seem to synchronize her conversations with her father. Even when they were face to face, they never achieved a natural rhythm. Would their relationship have been less awkward if he and her mother had stayed together? She'd always wondered.
Her father cleared his throat. Your mother mentioned you were having a spot of trouble?
Pause.
Thanks, Dad, said Tess at the same time as her father said, I'm sorry to hear that.
Tess could see her mother rolling her eyes, and she turned away slightly towards the car window, as if to protect her poor, hopeless father from her mother's scorn.
"If there's anything I can do," said her father, "just, you know, call."
"Absolutely," said Tess.
Pause.
"Well, I should go," said Tess, at the same time as her father said, "I liked the fellow." "Tell him I emailed him a link for that wine appreciation course I was telling him about," said her mother.
"Shh!"
Tess waved her hand irritably at Lucy.
"What's that, Dad?"
"Will," said her father. "I thought he was a good bloke." "That's no bloody help to you, though, is it, love?"
"He'll never do it, of course," murmured her mother, examining her cuticles. "Don't know why I bother. The man doesn't want to be happy."
"Thanks for calling, Dad," said Tess at the same time as her father said, "How's the little man doing?"
"Liam is great," said Tess. "He's right here. Do you want..."
"I'll let you go, love. You take care now." He was gone. He always finished the call in a sudden, frantic rush, as if the phone was bugged by the police and he had to get off before they tracked down his location. His location was a small, flat, treeless town on the opposite side of the country in Western Australia, where he had mysteriously chosen to live 5 years ago.
"Had a whole heap of helpful advice, then, did he?"
said Lucy.
"He did his best, Mum," said Tess.
"Oh, I'm sure he did," said her mother, with satisfaction.
Chapter 8. So it was a Sunday when they put the wall up. They called it Barbed Wire Sunday. "You want to know why?" said Esther from the back seat of the car. It was a rhetorical question. Of course they did. "Because everyone woke up in the morning and there was like this long barbed wire fence right through the city."
"So what?" said Polly. "I've seen a barbed wire fence before."
"But you weren't allowed to cross it," said Esther. "You were stuck. You know how we live on this side of the Pacific Highway and Grandma lives on the other side?"
"Yeah,"
said Polly uncertainly. She wasn't too clear on where anyone lived.
"It would be like there was a barbed wire fence all along the Pacific Highway and we couldn't visit Grandma anymore."
"That would be such a pity,"
murmured Cecilia as she looked over her shoulder to change lanes. She'd been to visit her mother this morning after her Zumba class and had spent 20 full minutes she couldn't spare looking through a portfolio of her nephew's preschool work. Bridget was sending Sam to an exclusive, obscenely priced preschool, and Cecilia's mother couldn't decide whether to be delighted or disgusted about it. She had settled for hysterical.
"I bet you didn't get a portfolio like this at that sweet, ordinary little preschool your girls went to," her mother had said, while Cecilia tried to flip the pages faster. She was going shopping for all the non-perishables in preparation for Sunday before she picked up the girls. "Actually,